Hi, it's Isidore, and welcome to Friendly Neighborhood Libertarian. Today we have on Tom Palmer, who is the Executive Vice President of the International Affairs section of the Atlas Network, and an all-around genius. And we're going to basically be talking to him about his impact on the liberty movement. So, Tom, it's nice to have you on here today.
Well, such a pleasure, Isidore. Thank you for the invitation.
So do you want to tell us a little bit about how you originally got into the libertarian movement and what it means to you?
Well, it was a very, very long time ago. And so many things have happened since then. But I think a very important moment for me as a very young person, a teenager, was to come into contact with the writings of Frederick Bastiat. He's really my hero, and I have maintained a great affection for him in the intervening 50 years. Bastiat was a systematic and careful thinker. He wrote in such simple and plain language that anybody can understand him. A taxi driver, a medical doctor, a farmer, even a prime minister can understand what Bastiat is saying. And he also has a certain generosity of spirit that is something that I learned is important over time. He's not mean or cruel. He's sometimes humorous, but never in a nasty way. He wants to help people to understand the beauty of living as a free person and letting other people live as free people, neither dominating nor being dominated. And so I've dedicated some of my effort to helping people to translate Bastiat into their own languages, into Chinese and Nepali and Kiswahili and Vietnamese and many, many other languages, because it's about sharing that message of liberty. So that's more or less how I got started. I've done a lot of things, worked against the military conscription and foreign interventionism, in favor of legalization of narcotics and ending the drug war. And what's important to me is not that these are some special interest. By the time I was working on military conscription, I was not eligible for it. But it's wrong to enslave other people. I don't take narcotics or smoke marijuana. I don't like it. It's not part of my life. But it's wrong to put other people in a cage for owning a plant or for relaxing in a way that doesn't appeal to me. So these are, in my opinion, important tests of what it means to be a real libertarian, is that you love the freedom of other people and not just your own.
So, I was gonna ask you, you said you started with Bastiat. Did like a professor or something lead you to him? Or was this like sort of an organic just discovery while reading?
Well, there's an organization that's still around, which I credit with having a great influence on my thinking when I was very young. I outgrew it, not in the sense that I abandoned it, but other things were interesting to me. And I don't think they'd be offended by my saying that also. It's the Foundation for Economic Education, FEE.org. It's a great organization. I'm a financial donor. I later served on their board for 9 years. I'm very, very fond of FEE. And it's a great door into the world of ideas and particular ideas about liberty. And I got the magazine, The Freeman, which is now defunct. They don't publish it anymore. But every month I would get this little magazine through the post. I also had come into contact with a very wonderful person. She passed away many years ago. Her name was P.K. Slocum, and she sold books, P.K. Slocum bookseller. And she told me, and I was about 15, and she was unbelievably old, like 50 or something like that at the time. But when you're 15, that seems ancient. And she said, well, when she started in the 1950s selling books, she thought people wouldn't buy books from a woman. Now, how the world has changed for the better since then. But she would find books for me. This is before the internet and computers and all that, where you can search for things. Now I use bookfinder.com and Abe Books and so on. But she'd find obscure books for me and she would sell them at a discount. And sometimes she would just find a book and I'd get it in the post with a little note. one of the things that was very important about PK, God bless her, was she told me that I needed to read all the other sides. Don't just read the things you already agree with and deepen your knowledge of that. Read the things you don't agree with. And given her generation, having come in contact with and fought against the communism and national socialism and fascism, she said, you need to read those writers too and understand why they don't agree with us, why they believe in enslaving other people, why they believe in force as the primary ordering foundation of society. And indeed, a while ago, I was rereading some works by Marx and by Lenin, and I picked one off my shelf, and there it had in her beautiful script, she said, to Tom Palmer from Comrade PK. And she said, you need to read and understand these books and understand socialist ideas and communist ideas and fascist ideas, as well as libertarian ideas. And I took that to heart, and I think it helped me to be a better person as a consequence. So yeah. Those are important in my development. You know, lots of other things happen when you live a few years. If you're an interesting person at all, and I try to be at least a little interesting, you're not influenced by only one thing or one writer.
Yeah, no, definitely. So about that, you mentioned that you translated a bunch of Basquiat's books into like 6 or 7 different languages. Are you a polyglot?
I want to be very precise and accurate. If that's the impression I left, then I spoke loosely. I have assisted or supported other people in doing that. I don't speak Nepali or Kiswahili or Vietnamese. So, and it's actually been about 40 different languages so far. But when I meet people who share this love of freedom and they read Basquiat in English or French or his original language or Russian or some other language that it's appeared in, they say, this is so wonderful. I'll say, well, how about bring it out in your own language? Ideally, of course, you want to translate from French. When you do a double translation, it introduces all sorts of infelicities and even errors. But if they translate it from English or Spanish or Russian or something into their own language, I always encourage them to get a professor of French from their university or from their country or a French speaker who can check it to make sure that it's correct. So I do not have the ability to translate from French into Nepali. Would that I had that.
That would still be like really cool. And you also mentioned how, sorry, I just had a brain fart. I guess what my next question is, how do you think libertarian philosophy has progressed in your lifetime? Do you feel like the spirit that your bookseller had about listening to different perspectives is something that still is upheld? Or do you think it's more like a symptom of our society in general?
I'm not sure that I quite get your point. I would make the following claim, though, and that is that there was a time when upholding the ideas of classical liberalism, which I think is a better name, or just liberalism, I think is the right name, how these ideas are known in most of the world. Libertarian was used in the US because liberal was taken by other people who would be called social democrats in Europe. Joseph Schumpeter said it was a supreme, if unintended, compliment that the enemies of free enterprise paid to that system by adopting its name for themselves. But for some time, if you were a person in the US who believed in the right of people to manage their own affairs, of privacy in one's personal life, freedom of speech and in free enterprise and limited government, you were considered kind of odd. There were left and right, and you're supposed to fit into one or the other. And so to uphold these ideas was, and to do so on the basis of some kind of deep principle rather than just personal interest, was considered weird. And that's no longer the case. Now people understand that it more or less fits together. It's coherent to say, I don't want to steal your house, and I don't want to break in and tell you what you can or cannot smoke or read or whom you may marry or whatever it happens to be. So to that extent, these ideas have become second nature for lots of people. They don't strike them as being odd or strange. I think that's been a big advance. And I think that's because of organizations like Cato Institute and people being on the media and television and radio and so on the internet arguing these things. I take a wider view about the liberty movement than just those who might insist on the purity of their ideas. I don't much like ideological purity tests where I say, okay, Isidore, I'm going to give you 100 questions. And if you agree with me on all 100 of them, you get to be a libertarian. It gets a little bit silly, in particular because that sectarian mindset often is focused on believing what was believed by some important or dazzling figure in the past. And those become sects, they become cults. And I think cults are ugly in lots of ways, one of which is they turn your brain off. Instead of thinking about the world, you go to the sacred book. So this happened to a very substantial degree to Marxism. But I think it happens also among self-identified libertarians as well, that everything Ayn Rand said, and only Ayn Rand has the truth on something, or Ludwig von Mises or whatever. I rather like the approach that Hayek had. He said he hoped that there would never be any Hayekians. He thought that was terrible, that these people who call themselves by the name of their teacher or inspiring figure were never, ever as good as the person who, after whom they name themselves. And they become caricatures, in effect. So people who say, I'm a this or a that, and they name a person, in effect, they're giving up the power of their own independent reason. And of course, the irony is when they do that, naming themselves after someone who argued for the importance of reason and evidence. So there's an irony involved in that. But I think it's harmful and destructive. And that's one reason why I even think that organizations are rarely well served by naming themselves after some important figure, even if it's someone I really cherish and admire, like Frederick Bastiat. I said, you know, you don't want to be stuck calling the Bastiat Institute, with all respect to those that are called that. And then you have to defend every little jot and tittle of what he wrote or believed or every element of his life. I think that's a mistake, because you end up being like a religious cult.
Yeah, do you think cultishness is something that is like natural for people and something that like needs to be unlearned or, you know, taught to be resisted? Or
it's often something people also outgrow. I mentioned outgrowing fee in a certain sense. I want to clarify that. I just meant that my interest went into lots of other things also. And I still hold them very dear to my heart. I think it's an important organization and I'm happy to support them. But you can outgrow this cultishness. It's very common, especially among quite young people, to latch on to something that they think has the answer for everything. And there are no hard problems anymore. I go and I check it out, or I've got some algorithm that I just apply, and every case, pop, out comes the answer. So I have this absolute certainty. And that absolute certainty is something that many people desire in life. But I think that most people, as they get older, discover, well, there are some really hard problems. There are things where even rational and reasonable people, even presented with the same evidence, might end up with different conclusions. Whereas the culty mentality says, aha, a sign they are evil. They're evil. They know the truth and they reject it. So we have to smash them or destroy them or excommunicate them or hurt them. Rather than saying, well, you know, sometimes we do come to different conclusions. And sometimes there are really hard problems that we face. And one of the hardest things of all that I had to teach myself to say is, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. Maybe I could find out. Maybe there is an answer. But at least at the moment, I'm not sufficiently well informed who have any kind of strong opinion on this question. That's something that teenagers usually don't like to say. That's okay. That comes with the territory of being very young. It is something that tends to come with age. What is so sad is when you meet people who are 40 who have not been able to learn to say that. They still have the mentality of the teenager. And there are lots of those people out there.
That's really interesting. It sounds like you're sort of trying to channel almost like a John Stuart Mill type interpretation of like an acceptance of like being able to be challenged in terms of understanding.
I don't think I'm channeling anybody. I think it's just part of growing up. It's also something you find if you read Aristotle's books on ethics and on politics, which I think are well worth reading and studying, not just to find out what he thought, but because they're insights into life. And by the way, in saying that, I don't agree with him on lots of things, given especially his very limited experience of what a political order could be and its limitations to a small city state, if you will. But it's about learning that life's complicated. And that's one of the reasons why he thought you really shouldn't teach people ethics until they were of a certain age. I don't remember, 30 or something like that, because they don't have any experience on which to meditate and to think about what is the right thing in life. Now, that's too strongly formulated. Of course, a 20-year-old can study ethics and can strive to be a good person, but it does help to have the experience of the complexity of the world. And I think that it tempers the view that I just know the answer to everything. There's also an intellectual deformation, I might put it that way, why the thinking of Ludwig von Mises is so attractive to some people. I'm a great admirer of Ludwig von Mises. I read maybe all of his books at one point or another when I was young, and I certainly enjoyed them and I learned from them and I was challenged by them. But he had a method, not so much how he worked, but what he presented in his books, of apodictic certainty, that the claims that he made had to be true, that you were somehow contradicting yourself if you disagreed with them. I don't think that's a good method for social science inquiry. I also don't think it characterizes what Mises himself actually did. It's a kind of formalization of his model of inquiry, but it's very appealing to an immature mentality, because now I know the answer to everything and I can just deduce the world. I can start with some principles and I can deduce the world. And I think that that is shallow. And it's a kind of evacuation of your own reason from your mind. And then finally, it opens the way to cultism. It seems to be naturally affiliated with this view that I have the truth because I have the true book. And naturally, those who are the high priests of the true book have also the truths. And so I should follow them on whatever it happens to be. And ultimately, I think this is personally destructive, and it has contributed to some degree to an illiberal, anti-libertarian mentality in politics. We want to crush and destroy our enemies rather than help people to learn how to live in peace with each other.
Yeah, on that, do you think that some of that has to do with the way that we're taught in university?
I'm not sure. Why do you think that? What do you think? And then,
yeah, I mean, like, I've noticed when I've been at my school that there really hasn't been very many perspectives or worldviews that are competing. I might not be the biggest fan of Marxism, but I've like read a lot more of it than what is being talked about. And the same is true with some more of the classical liberal thinkers, or even like the free energy principleists and logical positivists. Do you think that religion, or do you think that universities sort of teach a sort of religious style of teaching which encourages being stuck in ways, or do you think it like fundamentally opens the door to more to a more open-minded mindset?
Well, certainly when they do their job right, it should be the latter.
Yeah, of course.
I can't really opine about what all universities are doing. There are so many of them, and I don't have a strong opinion on this matter. There are some that are pretty terrible, that impose a doctrine or a dogma on the students, and then there are others that are introducing them to ideas. In my limited teaching experience, which is not very much, outside of think tanks and so on, but at universities, I was very proud when at the end of a term on political thought, the students asked me what my views were. And I thought, I did my job. A very careful observer would have looked at my reading list and seen that there were a few people like Bastiat on the list that were not standard for others who are teaching those courses. But I was very proud because I wanted them to grapple with Rousseau and with Locke and with Marx and with Mill and many others and see the strengths and the weaknesses of these arguments. And then they asked me what I thought. So I felt really good about myself. I was being paid for it, and I said I earned my money. I was not being paid to indoctrinate people or to convert them. Afterwards, we then had fruitful conversations, and I explained what I thought. We had nice conversations about that. I think that that is happening more than most people think in good colleges and universities, that you don't squash people. I have seen the other side, though. I remember at Oxford University, a seminar I took part in 1994, after in the United States, the Republicans had taken the House of Representatives. And they were two left of center professors, Ronald Dworkin and Bernard Williams. Dworkin was an American, and Williams was a Brit and a Labor Party member. And Dworkin said, the purpose of this seminar is to come up with arguments to convince ignorant home county Tory voters why they should vote Labor. It's really shocking. And Williams said, really, Ronnie, is that the purpose of a seminar at Oxford University, to come up with talking points for a political party? He was the gentleman in that regard. And related to that, Dworkin belittled and mocked students who raised questions he didn't agree with. And I thought, oh my God, that's a standard of how not to behave. It's one thing to challenge, but he mocked and made fun of them because they were Conservative Party members. And I said, oh, that's just not how I want to be. And Williams, in contrast, who was possibly more left-wing than Dworkin was much more the gentleman encouraging people to come up with, to develop their thoughts and to pursue lines of inquiry. So it does happen, but I don't think it's the universities that are responsible for a kind of monoculture per se. That said, I'm not as closely connected to so many universities that I have a really strong opinion on the question.
Yeah, I totally understand that. I was just curious about your perspective on that. So another thing I wanted to talk about is the divide between left and right wing libertarians. Do you think that that's a meaningful distinction? Or do you think that sort of gets people caught up in like a little bit of cultishness?
Yeah, I actually don't understand what it means when people have raised these questions. I don't get it. It sounds like a little tiny corner of the internet where people are just arguing endlessly with each other over minutia. So I don't think that there's I don't get it. I don't know what is the difference between these things. Now, some have argued incorrectly, in my opinion, that there is a robust cultural connection. You can only support a free society if you are a member of a religion, usually Christianity or Judeo-Christian, who knows what. And if you're not, then you can't be for liberty. And then they make really, really weak arguments that I think are just laughable about why that has to be the case. And I think that's, again, a sign of a cultishness. It's kooky. I think that the arguments are utterly risible. You should be able to see through them immediately. The fact is that free society has place for lots of different ways of living, religions. I work with many liberal friends who are very pious Muslims, observant Jews, pious and observant Hindus, Eastern Orthodox Christians, Western Latin Christians, Protestants, non-believers, you name it. What it means to be a libertarian is to believe in liberty for other people. It's not something that embraces all of your philosophy of life.
Because then it wouldn't be free.
Yes, I think that then it just becomes another kind of a dictatorship. And so we see crazy people advocating this kind of view, like this Hans Happy fellow who says that homosexuality is incompatible with libertarianism. I mean, what a crazy idea. Just like utterly crazy. And they should be physically excluded from society. This is a crackpot, in my opinion.
Yeah, of course.
And in an example of someone who started looking for absolute certainty, the answer to everything, that's what motivated him, couldn't find it in Jürgen Habermas. And so I said, oh, well, he finds this Murray Rothbard, who was a highly opinionated person who had lots of opinions on everything, latches onto that. And then these things just spin out. Whatever someone says has to be true because he said it. And then you end up with just utter insanity, in my opinion. So this is a real intellectual, and I would even say moral, dead end.
Yeah, so I'm wondering if there's also a distinction between the styles of thinking about liberty. In the sense that, like, you know, we could talk about like the culty people over down like the Mises stuff, or we could also talk about the contractarians of Buchanan versus like the Benjamin Tucker like anarchists. Do you think that like these groups are able to like function together in the same movement, or do you think that these movements are to some degree like really separable upon the ground that they stand?
Well, if you have people who have different views about the proper foundations of government or its limits, doesn't mean that they can't be together in a common political movement. All those people think that there are limits to what the state should do, and they can certainly unite on that. When you think about what are the best ways for thinking about political order generally, well, then there are a number of different, we could identify schools, if you will, different ways of approaching problems of complex social organization, different arguments about why people have rights or what their justifications are, or how we cash them out in different circumstances. But you still have a remarkable overlap in supporting the principles of the free society. And reasonable people can have discussions at a learned level, at the learned societies of various kinds about these things. But I think it's a mistake to put on your little lapel pin or hat that says I'm a this or a that, and then charge off to go and refute the other people.
Yeah.
That's silly. The other point is that the view of intellectual history or of the mind that argues that there are these little boxes and everyone has to fit into a box shows, a naivete about the history of culture and of the mind. So you hear frequently, oh, are you a utilitarian? Do you care about consequences? Utilitarianism being a subset of consequentialism generally, or do you believe in natural rights? One or the other. And then those, because those are little boxes that we have on our table, and then they'll go to some thinker of the past and say, wait a minute, this person talks about both. That person is confused. So this great thinker, David Hume, or John Locke, or Immanuel Kant, or whoever it is confused because he or she doesn't fit into the boxes I made. Well, that's silly. And in the case of believing in appeal to utility or to rights or natural rights, one of the signs that a right is natural, if you will, is that it generates good consequences, that it helps people to live together, to flourish as human beings. It's not the case we have to pick one or the other. So I think that this mentality of dividing up the world into all these little competing schools, little sects, if you will, and then see them squabble amongst each other is not intellectually healthy to begin with. And it is an imposition on the actual history of people trying to work out how the world works of our little systematization. And then everyone has to fit into the box. And if you're in one box and not another one, somehow you can't have anything in common with them. You can't bridge them. You can't be connected to them.
Yeah.
I just see the world differently from that kind of taxonomy where you take everyone, you put a little pin through their thorax and stick them onto a board like a whole bunch of moths or beetles.
I like that metaphor. But do you think that there are core beliefs for being libertarian, or are there not core beliefs, and how does that work? Or do you see because I know that I've heard some religions like Buddhism argue that everyone's a Buddhist. Do you subscribe to that sort of idea?
No, but although I think there's an element in which almost everyone lives their lives in accordance with libertarian principles, and I think that's an important point. I think that the core idea is the presumption of liberty. And we need to flesh this out. There's a very, very good book by George H. Smith, published by Cambridge University Press a few years ago, highly accessible, very, very readable, that I think makes the case very strong. And the core idea is the presumption of liberty, that people should be presumed to be able to, that they should be able to do what they want with their own lives, and with what is theirs. And that means we then have to address the question of what is property, what is theirs and what is not theirs, and so on, unless there's a strong reason for them to be restrained in some way. And there may be such reasons. This current pandemic has raised these questions in a very strong way. Is there a reason to restrict people in having large gatherings where people hug and kiss, which is what lots of people do at religious meetings and so on, and church meetings and the like? Do these become super spreaders, and do they then spread those contagious illnesses to other parties who are not willing participants in this? So as we saw in South Korea, one of the big super spreader events was a large church congregation. And in that church, people are very physical and they hug each other a lot. And then they all scattered to the different corners of the Korean peninsula and infected people on the trains and airplanes and family members who infected the people down at the local corner store and so on. Well, that might be a reason that people should not be able to have those big events because of the spillover impact. I'm not saying that it's an open and shut case, but it raises those questions. And I don't think that it's interesting. No, people should be able to do everything that they want to do. Well, what if it's harmful to other people? So it's a presumption of liberty, but it's a rebuttable presumption. In contrast, the other side thinks of a presumption of power, that you have to prove why you should be allowed to do something. And that shows a distinction between the idea of bills of rights as they emerged in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, and those that then were articulated in the mainly second half of the 20th century. The first one, say, like the American one, Congress shall not, Congress shall not, Congress shall not. There's a presumption you can do what you want, and there's a limit on their power. Now they say, well, you have a special right to X, Y, and Z, which is to say there's a plenum or a filled space of power, but these little rights are carved out for you, as opposed to saying you have the presumption to do what you want. So if you look at the Ninth Amendment to the United States Constitution, it really articulates this very neatly. The Ninth and Tenth Amendments have that libertarian approach, I think very well done, that the enumeration of certain rights in the Constitution shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Right? It's very, very clear. We listed some rights, but they're not all the ones that you have. And then the 10th Amendment says if the powers are not enumerated and delegated, they don't have them. In contrast, the later ones say, well, the state can do whatever it wants. In effect, that's the background. We're going to carve out these little extra special rights. So it's very much like the presumption of innocence. You don't have to prove you're innocent. The prosecutor has to prove that you're guilty. You can't go around proving that you're innocent of any possible charge made against you. The burden of proof is too high. And the presumption of liberty rests on essentially the same epistemic grounds. So I think that's the core of it. Now, then the final point, I think that most people live their lives in a libertarian way. They don't go around beating people up if they don't like what they think. If someone else has something you want, you don't just punch them in the face, beat them to the ground and take it. If you see it in a window, you don't smash the window and take it. If you want labor services, you hire people to do cook food for you or mow your lawn or wash your car. You don't hold them at gunpoint and force them to do those things. And libertarianism is about theorizing our practice. And the practice of most people in the modern world is 100% compatible with libertarianism. And so the question is, you act like a libertarian, why not be one?
Yeah. I wanted to interrogate this a little bit more. You talk about liberty, but you don't really define it. Are there different types of liberty? Because some people argue for liberty as in, if someone is starving, they're not free. And that's a common sort of criticism that other factions sort of lay at the feet of libertarians. Do you feel like this sort of thing is compatible or... how do you sort of conceptualize this sort of objection that freedom is debatable?
Well, of course it is. And that's virtually everything is debatable in that sense. This goes all the way back to Plato, that a person who's engaging in wrongful action can't be free. The action is wrong. So there's something that's keeping him from freedom. It might be ignorance of what is the right thing to do, or it might be desire, of course, that overpowers your reason. I think that the person who would address this most intelligently, well, there are two, actually, and I would encourage your listeners to go and get these essays. Isaiah Berlin, in his Two Concepts of Liberty, is a brilliant, thoughtful meditation on these ideas. And one of those concepts of liberty ultimately is the foundation of the totalitarian state. We liberate you to do what you really want to do, but you were too ignorant or benighted or befuddled to know what you really wanted. And that of course traces back to Rousseau, who argues this in the social contract, we will force you to be free. And we're going to liberate the real you and strip away the false consciousness, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that obstructs the real you. And we will truly free you when you agree with what you ought to agree with. As opposed to the approach that has been associated with liberalism, which is in a way more empirical, the poor little empirical soul, you or me, we have ideas about what we want to do in life and accomplish, and pays honor to that. The other writer who addressed this question from a slightly different perspective, but it has important parallels, is Benjamin Constant, spelled Constant, C-O-N-S-T-A-N-T. And you can get his essay on the liberty of the ancients compared to that of the moderns, which at Liberty Fund, they have it at the Online Library of Liberty. It's a wonderful, deep, thoughtful meditation, I think it was from 1819, about two concepts of liberty that were in contest. And what is interesting is not only does he use it to interpret how the French Revolution went so badly off track, if you will, ended up with the terror, because they deployed this idea of ancient liberty found in the polities of the ancient world when it wasn't appropriate to the modern world. And then the second point was, he said, well, when we enjoy our modern liberty, which we would identify with individual liberty, if libertarians see it, don't give up your ancient liberty so easily. You should be a part of the public sphere. You should participate in politics. It was an election speech, by the way. Well, there are not many election speeches today written at such a high intellectual level, but he was encouraging people to go out and vote for the liberal cause in the elections. And he says, if you say, well, I'm just going to enjoy my own private freedom, manage my own life, and not worry about the public sphere, you won't enjoy that freedom for very long. The politicians will say, fine, we'll take care of all of this. You just worry yourself with your own little private life, and we'll handle the big questions, and soon you'll find that your liberty will be stripped from you.
Why do you think politicians do that?
Why do I think that they want power?
Like, why do you think they continually expand like their dominion over everyone? Do you believe that politicians like are fundamentally power hungry, or do you think that this is more just happenstance?
Well, I don't think it's politicians that are power hungry. I think it's human beings, and politicians are human beings, so most of them are going to be like that. The desire to dominate other people, to coerce them, to compel them to live as we want, is almost a constant in human history. And so I don't think it's that there's this special class of evil people that we call politicians. They're just human beings like you and me, and some of them went into politics. And it could be that there was some who had more of that taste for dominating others, and they're the ones who are gravitate to it. But I think all of us have the capacity within ourselves to cruelty, to evil, to domination. I don't think that there's anyone out there who's just a pure person that never would want to hurt anybody else. It's lurking in there someplace. And civilization is about learning to control that. We don't hit people when they say things disagreeable with us. We learn that. Children often do. And they have to learn, sometimes through unpleasant experience, that you don't hit other people, you don't take your stuff, and you don't lie to them. Three fundamental principles of a civil society, as David Hume articulated it, and it's what most people teach their children. So those principles have to be learned. What we need to do is to learn to control our desire to dominate other people. And unfortunately, let's turn back to American politics in particular. Right now, there's a culture war that's been unleashed by both the left and the right, the politically correct left, who are not content with just living as they want. They want to force traditional fundamentalist religious congregations and others to, by golly, repent and live the way we want them to live. We have to crush them. And then, of course, the reaction, which is, well, two can play that game. We're going to turn around and do that to you. And so President Trump is now openly calling for a culture war. This will not end well if it continues in that way, because one side has to hurt, dominate, and destroy the other, as opposed to a social order in which, you know, if you want to live a conservative kind of life, if you want to be a conservative member of the Mormon church and have that kind of family-centric life with your religious congregation, why not? It's part of a free society too. Or to be an Orthodox Jew or a non-believer or a Buddhist in the middle of Minneapolis, whatever it is, free society has place for all of those ways of life. We don't need a culture war. Naturally, however, human beings are drawn to tribalism. There's a very good book by Joshua Green called Moral Tribes, which I thought was quite good, professor of psychology at Harvard University. And he argues, in a nutshell, that we were so excited by the good news of discovering that human beings can be naturally social. We can cooperate. Think about the work in game theory, Robert Axelrod and others. It's very exciting. We can learn to cooperate. Well, that's great, but there's a little bit of a dark side. A great deal of the cooperative impulse or the channels of cooperation that are hardwired into the human mind are ways for us to cooperate in order to crush and defeat the other group. And that's this tribal cooperation. We will cooperate and express our solidarity with ourselves to go and loot, pillage, destroy, rape the other group. And the question is, how can we control that kind of cooperation? In the current election campaign, we are seeing the tribalism unleashed. And I think it's very important for us to restrain that, to try and bring us back to ourselves as conscious and moral agents who recognize the humanity of other people and not be so driven to want to destroy and annihilate the other tribe. So tribalism and domination are part of the human nature as much as cooperation and laissez-faire.
How does that situate with animal rights? I'm really interested because I know that, I believe you're interested in animal rights too, right, Tom?
I wouldn't put it in terms of rights per se. This is a difficult area to think about. It's very important, but I do believe that we should avoid harming animals who can experience pain and suffering and fear. And so I gave up eating meat some time ago, not alone in that. My late friend, Judge Stephen F. Williams, who we lost recently, was a great friend of Liberty also, federal judge. He passed away from the coronavirus over the summer. He also became a vegetarian rather late in life when he learned about factory farming of animals. He said, this is unsupportable. And from that moment forward, he didn't kill animals or participate in their killing. So I think that that's a part of a moral awareness. It's fully compatible with libertarianism. I would not make the stronger claim to say that someone can't be a libertarian if they eat animals. But I think that it is that my view is compatible fully with my moral views. It kind of falls out of them in some ways. But I wouldn't make the stronger claim that they are engaging in some kind of logical mistake if they don't agree with me. That said, I'm also happy that now we're so wealthy that we can live in a society where I can have all kinds of delicious, tasty food, some of which satisfies meat cravings that I had because I grew up eating meat. And we're so rich that I can have Beyond Meat and other things like that, that satisfy that, but didn't lead to any cruelty.
That's really nice.
Well, it's part of living in a prosperous society that we're able to enjoy that.
Yeah, about that. I was talking to one of my friends who's talking about how some countries or some parts of countries choose to deindustrialize. Do you see that as something that's largely compatible with liberty in that like it's free from general domination? Or is it a different type of enslavement in that like your community largely controls the sort of things you have access to? Or is this just like a tough question?
We'd have to ask what deindustrialized means. If by that, what do you mean? It's big factories that make smoke and so on. We've been doing that for a long time. Industrialization doesn't mean big factories that make smoke and lots of noise. We have all kinds of industrial processes today that pollute a lot less. That's part of being wealthier. We invest in pollution control and so on. If what is meant is that some people prefer a life that is not as high tech, well, that's their business. Amish people live like that, and Old Order Mennonites, the Amish don't ride in automobiles, they don't use a lot of electricity and so on. They choose to introduce into their lives the kind of technology that they want. They're part of a free society. It's also a bit of a hard life. As you know, about 50% of their children, they say, are lost to the world. They don't continue on to adult baptism and participation in the community because it's a different and difficult life for them. But if that's how they want to live, I do respect them. I have no desire to tell them that they have to live like I do and have an iPhone. That's ridiculous. And maybe they have a kind of happiness that isn't available to me as a consequence. So I certainly respect them, but I would not want to go out on a moral campaign, as they also do not want to do that, and force people to give up their iPhones or vaccines or internet or whatever it happens to be. So people should be free to choose the involvement with technology that they want.
Yeah, I'm asking more. The Amish are a great example to illustrate my point, which is I was reading about how Amish children, while given the ability to leave like on paper, oftentimes are taught at up to like a fourth grade, like reading and math level, and don't really have like, this is like a practical option. Do you think that sort of thing, like as a tension, exists in society? And no. How do you?
No, well, first off, you could imagine an extreme case, which the Amish do not represent, in which children are kept in a closet and not allowed to speak and so on. That's abuse. That's disgusting, shocking abuse. And those occasional, very rare cases where parents are so, they're just such sociopaths, the children are taken from them, that's legitimate and appropriate, and there are terrible legal consequences for people who do that. The Amish do not do that. They educate them up to what is equivalent of an eighth grade education in the American system, so that they are literate, they're bilingual, and they're numerate. They have a basic understanding of geography and physics and so on. And yes, you can go out into the world with that. And I know people who left those orders. It's very difficult because they shun you. You lose everything. So the cost of exit is extremely high. The family won't talk to you anymore. So you could imagine the whole world is just falls round about you. And yet a very high percentage make that incredibly difficult choice. I don't see anything in that violates libertarian principles, even though I recoil from it, the thought of not talking to your children after they leave is, I find that hard. It's hard for me to imagine, but I've known people who have had to leave and had that experience. So yes, these extreme cases, but those people are acting as criminals. They're in effect kidnapping their own children. That's monstrous. The Amish don't do that. What you're leading up to, though, is there might be some minimal standards of what it means to equip someone to be an independent person in the world. And that's a very, very reasonable point. And I think that it's not just a theoretical point that somehow you and I have to grapple with. It's a real world problem that real courts deal with. And they deal also with difficult problems on the margin, like blood transfusions for Jehovah's Witnesses. One would not coerce an adult Jehovah's Witness who does not believe in transfusion of blood into taking it. That would be a terrible thing to do, a violation of their rights. But what about when you have a six-year-old child who isn't able to make that decision? And I think that courts in the United States, at least, have done a reasonable job of saying, look, we know these parents love their children. They're not saying they're bad parents, but the child will be taken away for the purpose of receiving a life-saving blood transfusion and then returned to those parents who are loving and good people. That's a hard problem. But I think that you know, the world has hard problems. And it's not just a problem for some particular political theory. These are problems for every normal person and for every legal system to grapple with. So they're not somehow unique to some little sect of libertarians puzzling these things out.
Yeah. I was just trying to like sort of, you know, map the area in which you're thinking about this in. So mm-hmm. Another question I wanted to ask you is about how early on in your career you were famous for smuggling in books to spread the language of liberty. Have you, do you want to tell me a little bit about that?
Well, in the 1980s, I and a few other people came to the conclusion that the communist states were brittle, that they weren't going to last. Now, it was an unusual view. Most people thought they're just part of the furniture of the world and they're going to be there forever. Henry Kissinger and others thought that. It was just a question of managing this long-term relationship. And I thought that wasn't the case. These systems were highly brittle and that they would collapse. So I began working with friends in Austria and moved to Austria and then started traveling and just meeting people. There's no internet really to speak of. It was quite primitive. Some universities had minimal things, but nothing in that part of the world. And I would go to places and just meet people. And that meant sometimes going to universities and just standing in the lobby and trying to talk to people and identifying people who are writing about issues of alternative models of socialist labor management, which meant free markets, right? And tried to go through it. So I met people, some of whom I'm still in touch with, they're much more advanced age, and met with them and said, yes, yes, what we're talking about is liberalism. And then tried to help them. I would bring them books and photocopying machines, fax machines, and then sponsored them to bring about translations for either underground publishing or, when it was possible, official, you know, textbook language publishing for such books as Paul Haynes' The Economic Way of Thinking, which is a wonderful textbook introduction. I have a little visitor here. My cat decided to come up to the discussion.
What's her name?
This one is Salman. She loves to be in Zoom calls. So Paul Haynes' book came out in Czech, in Romanian and Hungarian, in Russian, later Albanian. And then helping them with such things as what was called desktop publishing, which was the early laptops where you could format a document, a newsletter or something. And had a lot of interesting adventures, was arrested a number of times and learned about how to talk your way out of problems, how to keep all official documents that you have. So when someone says, why are you doing this? Why do you have these? I would say, I have an official invitation from the Academy of Sciences of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics to give lectures at the Moscow State University. Why are you bringing two photocopying machines? I said, well, my invitation is to deliver lectures there. I have to make notes for the students. There are no working photocopying machines. I always travel with two photocopying machines. And finally, they just would give up. So that was a experience for me to then help people to establish libertarian or liberal think tanks and clubs and publishing houses in a multitude of languages. And I'm still in touch with many of those people. Many, of course, have since passed away in the intervening years. And then I just kept doing that in subsequent years in the Arab world and the Arab and Muslim world and across other parts of the world as well. So that's been part of my role, has been as a missionary for ideas of free society.
That's really cool. On that same regard, you now are the Vice President of International Programs at the Atlas Network. How has your career changed in terms of that? Do you feel like you're doing radically different things?
No. Except I have the advantage that I get to work with lots of people who are much younger than I am and who are also excited about these things. The world has changed in lots of ways. We don't have a Soviet Union, although we do have a gangster fascist figure in the Kremlin, who is quite committed to opposing liberal ideas. But The world is different. I get to work with so many wonderful young people in what I do. And it's very rewarding. And it makes me happy to know that when I'm gone and I'm just dust and ashes, that there will be people who continue to promote these ideas and to help people to live lives of liberty, of dignity, of peace, and prosperity. So I love my job.
Yeah, it sounds like you really have lived your job too.
I once was asked a question by a financial donor to Cato Institute, with which I'm also affiliated as a senior fellow, And he said, he was a prosperous entrepreneur. He said, Tom, I'm curious because I had just been on the road a lot and I used to travel up until this insanity of the coronavirus, two thirds, sometimes three quarters of the year. 1 year, I think it was 2010, I calculated I had slept in airplane seats more nights than in my bed. And he said, what would you do if you had enough money, you didn't have to work? And I thought about it for a minute and I thought, well, I think I'd have more room for my library. I wouldn't have books in my kitchen and the bathrooms. And my life might change on the margins. Otherwise, I'd do what I do now. And I realized at that moment how very fortunate I am. But then I told him, I said, but don't tell the president of the Institute that. I would, if I were fabulously wealthy, I would do what I do now.
That's awesome. So my next question for you is, what sort of angles do you find particularly convincing when it comes to spreading liberty as the missionary that you are?
Well, I'll tell you, in terms of thinking about these things, one is to respect your audiences. So I'll go often and lecture in Singapore or Vietnam or Namibia or someplace. And I try to listen to people and to respect them. One thing I also ask when I go to a country that I think is probably reasonably good advice, I Google business culture in that country to learn what is, how you greet people and how not. And I've learned things over the years. In majority Muslim countries, I don't go up and stick my hand out to shake hands with women because they may be put in an awkward position as a consequence. I put my hand over my heart. Of course, I haven't been shaking hands for a long time. The virus now as well. But there are lots of things. I'll look that up. You just look up business etiquette for some country, and it's remarkable what you'll find. I also ask people, I say, can you, to my friends, give me a few pointers on how to behave as a gentleman. What is the proper thing to do? And I take those to heart. And then I listen to people. I don't try to mock them or make fun of them if they disagree with me. I'll say, well, you've raised an important question. Thank you for doing that. And then try to explore it. The other thing that is important, and here I disagree with a lot of conservatives that I think are not very thoughtful about these matters, I don't defend Western civilization or Western culture, whatever that is. It's one of these big terms that gets batted around and people can rarely define what they mean by it. What I defend is liberty. And those are not uniquely Western ideas, or whatever West is, again. But it's also the case when you say I defend Western ideas or Western culture. Well, let's see. Karl Marx was not Chinese. Right? He was German. Engels was German. Mussolini was Italian. Hitler was Austrian. We could go down the list. All of these articulators of the worst ideas of the last 150 years, they were European, so they were Westerners. So do I defend those?
No, you don't.
So there's this presumption that, oh, you must mean toleration or freedom or Western ideas. But they're not uniquely Western, and they do not exhaust what it means to be Western culture, which produced these different theories and ideas. My thesis is that every civilization, every culture has at least two narratives, a narrative of liberty, limited government, and toleration and respect, and a narrative of power and domination and slavishness towards rulers. And our job is to uncover the roots of those narratives of liberty in every civilization and culture, and then to connect those to contemporary questions and issues. So I do not go to other areas of the world and say, I'm here to defend a tradition foreign to you. I think it's false, and obviously it would be self-defeating.
Yeah, that definitely makes a lot of sense. My friends and I, when we've been reading the Zhuangzi, have noticed like a lot of libertarian themes in that. And it's been really interesting because, okay, excellent. Great. So let's go on to like the last question, which is, do you have any funny stories involved in spreading liberty? And are there any topic areas you want to tell me about?
Oh, funny stories. Well, yes. Can't think of any. Well, I'll tell you one thing. It's not particularly funny, but it was inspiring to me, and certainly memorable. I heard F.A. Hayek speak a number of times when he was alive, and was always impressed by him. He was such a remarkable person. By the way, the first time I saw him, he looked tiny and old. He was on television and he was very defeatist. It was, although my ideas are out of fashion and everything I've worked for will be over soon. It was very depressing many, many years ago in the 1970s. Then he got the Nobel Prize and he just woke up. It was an amazing transformation. But he was a very big man. He was quite tall, big Austrian mountain climber type. And he had huge hands. So I asked him to sign the copy of a book, Prices and Production, that he wrote in the 1930s. It's a pretty small little book. And when he held it in his hand, it looked like a toy book. He said, oh, he said, I haven't seen this book in many years. And he signed it for me. But the one moment that really impressed itself on me, he was asked a question at a public lecture that I attended. And it was a kind of technical question on economic methodology and psychology. And he said to the questioner, he said in this beautiful Austro-British accent he had, I gather that the form of your question, from the form of your question, you believe such and such. And the questioner said, yes, that's right. And then Hayek said, I also was of this opinion for about 50 years, but I've been thinking about it a great deal lately, and I think it was a fundamental mistake. And I was so impressed by that. I thought, wow, when I'm really old, I want to be like him. Still thinking about problems and able to say that a position he held for about 50 years was a fundamental mistake. That set the standard for me of intellectual inquiry. And that's the one I would want to share, that that's what we should strive to be like, and not just cookie cutter answers or not thinking or listening to other people, but to be always thinking and challenging ourselves in the process.
Well,
So
thank
let
you
me leave
so.
it at that.
Well, thank you so much, Tom. You're an inspiration, and I'm so glad that I got to talk to you today.
Well, the pleasure is all mine, Isidore. I expect great things from you long after I'm dead.